A realignment of choice. What distinguished Dutton's call for realignment from so many of the others that have appeared over the years was that, thanks to his position on the McGovern Commission, he had a certain amount of power to put his theories into effect. Every major realignment in U.S. political history, he declared in Changing Sources of Power, has been accompanied by the coming of a large new group into the electorate. And there's something to that. But what Dutton proposed and what the Democratic Party in fact undertook was something very different. A realignment of choice. Democratic leaders decided to reorient the party after 1968 not because this was necessary for survival, but because they distrusted their main constituency and had started to lust after a new and more sophisticated one. The crucial moment in that realignment, as I have mentioned, came in 1972. After the Democrats had reformed their presidential nominating process and chosen George McGovern himself as their candidate. The result was not a good one for Democrats, but they stayed the course. As a senator from South Dakota, McGovern had a decent record on working class issues, but the public identified him with the Democratic Party's new favorite group, affluent suburban liberals. In fact, according to one account, McGovern did better among these highly skilled professionals than he did with the Democrats' traditional blue-collar constituency, many of whom were lured away by the Richard Nixon re-election campaign. What this meant was that McGovern romped in prestigious college towns and also came out ahead in the college-heavy and distinctly professional state of Massachusetts. Nearly everywhere else, however, his particular demographic appeal was a recipe for disaster. He went down in one of the greatest electoral wipeouts in American history. Not everything was doom and debacle. Among other things, the McGovern campaign launched the political careers of several new generation Democrats, including the future Senator Gary Hart and the future President Bill Clinton, who worked on the 1972 campaign in Texas. And if you looked beneath the surface of McGovern's results, according to a 1974 book by the future Clinton associate Lanny Davis, you discovered that taking the professional vote away from Republicans wasn't necessarily a bad idea. The title of Davis's account was The Emerging Democratic Majority, a title that would reappear later in the long, dark decades of Democratic infighting and exile. And his argument was as follows. If Democrats could win back white working-class voters while hanging on to their new affluent suburban electorate, their triumph would be assured. But that never really happened. Instead, the party intensified its courtship of the comely professional managerial class. In 1974, in reaction to the Watergate scandal, a huge group of Democrats was elected to Congress. New school Democrats, that is, who seemed to be largely uninterested in traditional Democratic issues of economic equality. The new Democrats came out of the anti-war protests and the McGovern campaign, the Peace Corps and the women's movement, the professions and the suburbs, writes historian Jefferson Cowie, but not the union halls and the wards. Their de facto leader was the newly elected Senator Gary Hart, McGovern's former campaign manager, a man who made his name denouncing old-fashioned working-class politics in favor of a more tech-friendly vision. Hart became a symbol of the 60s generation's revolt against the workerist politics of their parents. The End of the New Deal was the title of Hart's standard 1974 campaign speech. He liked to mock old-school libs as Eleanor Roosevelt Democrats. Later on, Hart would lead the technology-minded politicians that the media nicknamed the Atari Democrats. His 1984 run for the Democratic presidential nomination was celebrated as a blow against the New Deal past. It was also the occasion for the media's discovery of the affluent and tasteful yuppie, the young urban professional whose rise was supposed to signal yet another break from the Democrats' traditional blue-collar demographic. The Jimmy Carter presidency was an earlier milestone. At first, Carter had seemed like a man who could recover the party's historic constituencies. But once in office, he broke with the New Deal tradition in all sorts of highly visible ways, canceling public works projects and conspicuously snubbing organized labor. With the help of a Democratic Congress, he enacted the first of the era's really big tax cuts for the rich, and also the first of the really big deregulations. As though to prove how tough and post-partisan he could be, in 1980, he and Paul Volcker, his hand-picked Fed chairman, put the country on an austerity diet that was spectacularly punishing to the ordinary working people who had once made up the Democratic base. Carter turned out to be a sort of archetype, the first in a series of passionless Democratic technocrats. That working people felt the brunt of Carter's policies was no coincidence. This was not a group for whom his administration felt a great deal of sympathy. In a 1981 interview looking back at the administration's deeds, Carter advisor Alfred Kahn, an economist, had this to say over the fights about deregulation and inflation. "I'd love the Teamsters to be worse off. I'd love the automobile workers to be worse off. You may say that's inhumane. I'm putting it rather baldly, but I want to eliminate a situation in which certain protected workers in industries insulated from competition can increase their wages much more rapidly than the average without regard to their merit or to what a free market would do, and in so doing exploit other workers." Now, this is a Democrat, remember, and what he was objecting to was the way unions supposedly allowed workers to prosper without regard to their merit. It's a view we shall hear again as we proceed. All these Democrats worked to sever their ties with the past, but for the nation's mainstream political commentators, the Democrats' reorientation was always and forever insufficient. Regardless of what they did, they still hadn't distanced themselves from the New Deal finally enough. They were still too beholden to manufacturing and blue-collar workers. Democrats would run for the presidency on a professional-friendly platform of high-minded post-partisanship and be rejected by the electorate, and then, in the aftermath, those same Democrats would be ritually denounced by Washington's TV thinkers as examples of the New Deal's exhaustion and irrelevance. It happened to the post-ideological Jimmy Carter in his bid for re-election. It happened to the budget-balancing Walter Mondale. It happened to the technocratic centrist Michael Dukakis. Each one of them magically transformed on the day of their defeat into an instructional film on why Democrats needed to embrace post-ideological, budget-balancing technocratic centrism. The collapse and end of the New Deal is one of the most frequently announced events in American media, wrote a political scientist in 1985. It was announced so often and so predictably in those days that cataloging it became an academic exercise in itself. The historian William Luchtenberg filled several chapters of his 1989 book In the Shadow of FDR with New Deal death notices of this kind. For example, after Carter's electoral disaster in 1980, Senator Paul Tsongas said, "Basically, the New Deal died yesterday." After the electoral disaster of 1984, syndicated columnist Joseph Kraft announced that the repudiation of Mondale was a repudiation of the Democratic Party that had emerged from the old Roosevelt coalition. After the electoral disaster of 1988, it was the same. Even though candidate Michael Dukakis had worked hard to distance himself from the New Deal and even from the word liberal. On the eternal return of the death of the New Deal, Luchtenberg himself wondered. It was far from clear why, if, as Gary Hart claimed, the New Deal was dead in 1974, it was necessary for him to kill it off in 1980 and again in 1984. Can we really blame the media for telling the story this way time after time? All the bright young Democrats with the postpartisan ideas were saying the same thing. All through the 70s and 80s, in fact, new waves of liberal thinkers kept washing up, divining from the political stars the same ideas: that labor unions were an economic drag and or dying fast, that industrial society itself had gone into eclipse, and that the future belonged to people like them, meaning always affluent professionals or some other highly educated and market-savvy cohort. The most exciting of these bright young thinkers were the tech-minded Washingtonians who called themselves the neoliberals. In the early 1980s, their bold thinkings were the subject of a manifesto an anthology, a collective biography, and countless news stories. To the reader of today, however, what stands out in their work is the distaste they expressed for organized labor and their enthusiasm for high-tech enterprises. The 1983 Neoliberal Manifesto, for example, blamed unions for the country's industrial problems, mourned all the waste involved in the Social Security program, and called for a war on public school teachers so that we might get a better education system and thereby more Route 128s and Silicon Valleys. It was all so modern, so very up-to-date. The solutions of the 30s will not solve the problems of the 80s. Proclaimed a book-length account of this band of cutting-edge thinkers. Our hero, announced one of the leaders of the bunch, is the risk-taking entrepreneur who creates new jobs and better products. The coming of the new Democrats. Success came eventually to these different democratic prophets of post-industrialism, but it was brought, ironically, by a group that initially distanced itself from the McGovern turn. I refer to the Democratic Leadership Council, or DLC, established by a group of white Southern politicians in 1985 and supposedly committed to the working-class voters the Democratic Party had left behind. As the DLC saw it, whenever Democrats lost an election, it was because their leaders were too weak on crime, too soft on communism, and too sympathetic to minorities. The DLC had a single-factor theory of politics, that voters had grown disgusted with the cultural liberalism of the post-McGovern era. Why did Carter lose in 1980? Too damn liberal. Why did Mondale lose in 1984? Still too liberal. Why did Dukakis lose in 1988? Liberal again! The DLC also had but a single prescription for this malady. The Democratic Party could only win if it moved to what they called the center, severing ties with its constituent groups and embracing certain free market policies of the right. Now, the essential flaw in this neat little syllogism flashed on and off like a neon sign that all three of the Democratic candidates in the 1980s had followed this exact strategy of shifting rightward and had lost anyway. What made the DLC succeed where others had failed, though, were the contradictions it managed to juggle. It was a bluntly pro-business force, friendly with lobbyists and funded by corporate backers, that nevertheless proclaimed itself as a warrior for the working class. It was a strictly inside-the-beltway operation that presented itself as the champion of forgotten Democrats. One of its early manifestos, for example, berated higher socioeconomic status Democrats for antagonizing working-class voters both culturally and economically by embracing, among other things, no-growth policies in the mid-70s just as the economy was beginning to grind to a halt. Why working-class voters were supposed to pine for balanced budgets, free trade treaties, and the rest of the items on the DLC wish list was a mystery. The answer, it would soon become clear, was that the DLC didn't really care all that much about working people in the first place. The aim of the group was to capture the Democratic Party for its lobbyist supporters by whatever means were at hand. And in the 1980s, claiming to represent the overlooked middle American probably seemed like a good gambit. By the early 1990s, however, the DLC's proletarian period was over. Instead, the group used different rhetoric to persuade Democrats to let them drive. Now its leaders talked about getting beyond left and right, about occupying the vital center, about themselves as visionary new Democrats. Empty phrases that nevertheless carry still a kind of hypnotic power over the technocratic Washington mind. Before long, the DLC had discovered the great cause on whose behalf it would henceforth make its demands. Not the forgotten worker, but the future. The post-industrial global economy. It was in order to do business in this new realm, the group's many manifestos declared, that we needed to reform entitlements, which is to say, Social Security, privatize government operations, open charter schools, get tough on crime, and all the rest of it. This was the DLC's futurist period, with everything exactly the same as in its earlier phase, except that the new economy had taken the place of the forgotten Democrat as the factor everyone needed to consider. Indeed, the group now seemed to revel in the imminent downfall of the working class. A remarkable artifact of this period was a 1995 cover story in the DLC magazine entitled "Beyond Repair, The Politics of the Machine Age Are Hopelessly Obsolete," in which the reader learns that, thanks to the near-miraculous capabilities of microelectronics, we are vanquishing scarcity. The reign of plenty that was to come meant that the venerable politics of class warfare is dying, but also that lots of people in society's lower ranks were going to get nowhere in the future. The insufficiently educated, it was said, would eat the dust like illiterate peasants in the age of steam. By then, one of the DLC's leaders had seated himself in the Oval Office, a story I will tell in the next three chapters. But allow me to step away from that chronological sequence for a moment to relate how the saga of the DLC ended. At first, remember, the group was critical of higher socioeconomic status Democrats for being too liberal. By 1998, however, they had completely reversed themselves. In that year, the Democratic Leadership Council published a manifesto announcing who history's lucky winners were going to be. And it was the same group of people the DLC had once reviled for dragging the Democrats to the left. To find this out, readers had to make their way through a preface declaring yet again that the New Deal era has ended, but then political scientists William Galston and Elaine Kmark were ready to divulge their finding. The new economy favors a rising learning class over a declining working class. Yes, a learning class. This cohort, which the authors also called wired workers, was made up of individuals who were better educated, more affluent, more mobile, and more self-reliant than others. These fine people were scheduled to dominate at least the first half of the 21st century, and both of the country's political parties would be required, on pain of utter destruction, to compete single-mindedly for their votes. Amazingly, the things that wired workers wanted were exactly the things that the Democratic Leadership Council had been pushing since its inception. Entitlement reform, free markets, charter schools, and the rest of it. Enter the Bubba. The different schools of Democratic Party reform that I have briefly described here are usually regarded as separate, if not mutually despising, tendencies. Frederick Dutton and his fellow worshippers at the Shrine of Enlightened Youth were part of what is called the New Politics persuasion. Among other things, they were open to cultural radicalism and strongly opposed the Vietnam War. The Democratic Leadership Council, on the other hand, were a faction of hippie-punching white Southerners who loved free markets and who ultimately discredited themselves many years later by whooping it up for the Iraq War. These factions appeared to be opponents, and yet there was a persistent habit of thought that united them. Regardless of what it was they were demanding, they all agreed that what stood in their way was the legacy of the New Deal, the Democratic Party's commitment to equality for working people. That was what had to end. Here is where our story takes its remarkable turn. Slowly but relentlessly, these different loser reform traditions came together. And as they did, the Democratic Party became a success. Bad ideas plus bad ideas turned out, in this case, to yield electoral victory. The exact point where these trajectories intersected was occupied by one Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas, a Rhodes Scholar, and a McGovern campaign worker, who had grown up to become the chairman of the DLC. He led the idealistic 60s generation and he warred with the teachers' union. He smoked dope and he never got high. He savored Fleetwood Mac and he got tough with welfare mothers. Here was the one-man synthesis of the grubby dialectic I have been describing, and he arrived in Washington to fulfill the sordid destiny of his class like Lenin arriving at the Finland station.